Hey guys, my name is Amy Coonan, and I'm your host for The Town Hall, Rubicon's first and only podcast where we share advice for techies, for earth lovers, and for penny pinchers. As much as I love the sound of my own voice, this broadcast is going to rely heavily on guests who are subject matter experts on everything, ranging from how to get your small business up and running, interviews with some of the brains behind your favorite apps, and even how to remove garbage from outer space. You never know who's going to pop up and join me next in studio, so make sure to subscribe to The Town Hall on iTunes to get our episodes downloaded directly. And if your boss is making you work through lunch or your commute is just too short and you miss something awesome, don't worry, we've got your back. You can check out our blog for recaps, reviews, and all things Town Hall. Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Town Hall. Today I am talking to a sustainability icon, an environmental visionary. He's an architect, he's an author, he's an award winner, and a bunch of other things that don't necessarily fit into my catchy alliteration. He's also with me today in the Rubicon studio, William McDonough. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Your career is extensive and innovating and very exciting, but I really want you to break down your childhood for me. Where were you born? How did you grow up? And how do you think that sparked your passion for environmental sustainability? And then we'll kind of walk through the career timeline.
Well, I was born in Japan in 1951. And as a baby, I remember being awakened by the farmers collecting our sewage and with the ox carts on the cobblestones. And my mother would sing us back to sleep. And she would sing about the honey wagons collecting the night soil for the farms. And so I always thought the farms in the city were one thing. And then from Japan, we moved to Hong Kong. So we had refugees, we had cholera, we had drought. And so a beautiful place and very interesting cultures. And then spent my summers in the Puget Sound of Washington State, in the Douglas firs and with the salmon and the orca. So it was quite a childhood back and forth.
Yeah. And your career is taking you down a bevy of different avenues and side streets in the sustainability space. So kind of walk me through your professional roadmap, if you will. How did we get to where we are today? And I don't mean, you know, necessarily sitting in the studio, but, you know, touch on some of the career highlights for me in terms of your life. I mean, this is a pretty incredible one.
Well, after high school in Connecticut, I went to France and ended up becoming a champagne blender while I was in college, which was at Dartmouth, where I was an undergraduate in the arts. And then I went to Yale for architecture
school. What does a champagne blender do?
Well, you look at about 180 different glasses of champagne, grapes, wines, and then you blend them to make a taste that after a second fermentation comes out tasting like the champagne you're looking for.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a coincidence because I started as a cavist in the cellars in a summer job and ended up in the tasting room. But then I went from Dartmouth before Yale, I went to Jordan and I worked for King Hussein. And I lived with the Bedouin on the east bank of the Jordan River, looking at settlements for the next 100 years, and lived in a Bedouin tent. Then I went to Yale, and then I started building the first solar heated house in Ireland while I was a student, because we had had the energy crisis. And I wanted to build my first houses by hand so I could understand that. Then I came to New York, did my apprenticeship with a big firm, and then started my own firm in 1981, designing a big ranch in Utah. Was sort of known for doing the first green office in New York for the Environmental Defense Fund. So we got into ecological design, won competitions, helped start the U.S. Green Building Council, wrote the Hanover Principles for the Earth Summit in Rio, designed for sustainability, and won a big award from President Clinton, Presidential Award for Sustainable Development, and just keep doing what I'm doing. Co-authored a book, Cradle to Cradle.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about next, you know, because there is a lot to unpack here. And you've had your hand in, so, like you said, so many different design projects. And one of the most notable works, of course, is the Cradle to Cradle design model. And the model spawned a book, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, which details, obviously, the work further. So for those that are unfamiliar with the concept, and as you know, we skew towards a younger audience that's trying to do the right thing for the planet, but just, you know, may not know how. Will you define the fundamentals of the C2C philosophy and provide some easily digestible examples for all of us? And then I also am very curious to hear about the book itself. It's a sustainable feat within itself. Isn't the paper made from like DuraBook technology?
Yes.
And what does that mean?
It's plastic. And the first book is what we call a technical nutrient.
Okay.
It's there for the industrial system and to be recycled. So it's just like having a water bottle.
That's crazy.
And then the second book is the upcycle.
Makes it waterproof?
It's waterproof, yeah. You can read it in the bathtub.
I'm going to. Yeah. That's awesome. And it's actually upcyclable as well, right? Because it's...
Everything is pretty much upcyclable.
And we'll get into more.
We can get into that. Yeah, make it better. Sure.
So let's back it up a bit. I got really excited when I was reading about the tech of the book because one of my favorite things to do is read in the bath, read in the pool, read on the beach. And it's just, I mean, it's how a book should be made. Yeah. Yeah. So let's back up and let's define cradle to cradle and kind of dig into that a bit more.
Sure. Well, in industry, we used to hear the term cradle to grave. And the idea was, where do we get it from? What happens to it when we finish with it? And it usually went to a landfill or incinerator. So cradle to grave. So what we're looking at is the idea of cradle to cradle is that it comes from the world and goes back into the world without destroying it and or just being thrown a hole in the ground. So we're eliminating the concept of waste itself. So it's not just be less bad, waste less. It's like design things that aren't waste. So we design things for next use. And so we also articulate that as biological nutrients. So we design things that are safe for nature, clothing you would wear on your body, things that go back to the natural world. And those are designed as biological nutrients, just like a cherry tree has blossoms and they turn into soil.
Right? Right.
What we call products of consumption. You can consume them and they go back to nature. But we've also seen that we have technical nutrition. In the last 5,000 years, humans started banging metals and things like that. And we make things like TVs, computers, cameras, and so on. These things we call technical nutrients. These are, when they're finished with them, they should go back to industry because they can't go back to nature.
Right.
So we design them as systems that can be disassembled in circular economies. And we call them products of service or products as a service. So what you want from the washing machine is to wash clothes.
Right.
What you get is steel, aluminum, chromium, rubber, glass, and that we think those materials can still belong to the companies as assets while you get the clean clothes. And that way, the businesses of the future can maintain their asset bases. So working with a company like Philips Lighting Company, they now lease the lighting. So you're getting the light from them. And they still own the indium and the gallium and the rare earths, so they can use them again for manufacturing. So we don't destroy the world as we have more products. So every time you have more products, the world gets better. Because we're reusing everything.
We're smiling right now. You can't see us, but like the light bulb just went off for me a little bit. Like
that was a light bulb.
Yes. Was. Because the concept, I mean, it just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Why wasn't anyone thinking like this before this started?
That's hard to know. A university called me and said they're using the book to teach rhetoric in the English language, how to make an argument for the language that I used to write it.
Right.
And I said, well, why'd you pick this book? And they said, because you've discovered the obvious. You read this book, and at the end you say, well, that was obvious. And then you realize it wasn't obvious at all before you read the book, which means you've made an argument, and it worked. And so the discovery of the obvious, I think, is really fun, especially for young people. Because as you're looking around the world curiously, wouldn't it be wonderful to discover the obvious? And the obvious thing is we should design things for next use, and we should eliminate the concept of waste. So we can clean up the oceans, upcycle. We can take those materials and put them through pyrolysis, take them back to oil and start over again, do it clean. We can design things that go back to soil and safely and so on. We can do this. And we now have blue jeans, we have t-shirts, we have clothing, furniture, cars.
And is it coming. Like a certification program?
It is.
From bigger companies like Philips, and then you say they're C2C certified.
Yeah.
Or are you guys creating the products as well?
No. We're basically advising the companies how to design this way. And Philips is one of the companies that is excited about these strategies. But, other companies, we have certified products. So in clothing, we now have the blue jeans and the t-shirts that are 100%. 100% of the molecules have been assessed for human ecological health. People are treated gracefully. They're all done with renewable power. They're all solar powered or wind powered in India. The water coming out of the factory is clean enough to drink. You know, it's the way the world should be. It's the way we want it.
Right. It's the obvious.
The obvious.
Yeah.
Clean, healthy production in cycles.
And what are some, you know, the washing machine that's what really kind of hit the epiphany for me. What are some other examples of some products that, you know, you want the service out of, but let's lease the material and keep the stuff from ourselves?
The business relationship can be any kind of relationship, but it's essentially stay in touch with the customers. So the one that we did that's sort of famous was for carpet for Shaw Industries. It's the largest carpet tile company in the world now. And It's owned by Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett. So these are smart financial people, but they're also into long-term production and value creation. So essentially, we redesigned the carpet from materials that are very suspect, PVC and so on.
PVC like in piping?
Yeah, the same kind of material, those polymers. But they in fires, they can be a problem because of
carpet and
burning.
Home,
yeah, burning PVC is associated with dangerous volatiles. So the idea is design the carpet so that it comes apart afterwards, so we can shred it, and the base is heavy and drops, and the fibers are light and go up, and separate them and make them into carpet again. So essentially, when you get the carpet from them, we call it storing your raw materials on the customer's floors. So when you order the carpet, you put it in your building or whatever,
yeah,
and then you have it, however you paid for it is fine. And then stay in touch with them, because when they want to go from pink to blue, you're not destroying the world and saying, oh no, I'm tearing out my carpet and getting a new carpet. The world's being destroyed. You call up and say, I'd like a new color carpet. And the new carpet comes from the factory in Georgia in a truck. They take the old carpet, which is the raw materials of their carpet. It's designed to be the raw materials of their carpet. So you don't have to go dig holes in the earth more to get more material. It is that. And they bring it back and they make new carpet. So carpet becomes carpet, becomes carpet. And we don't have to destroy the world to have carpet anytime we want. And if it's powered with renewable energy, every time you do this, the world gets better, and all we do is create jobs. So why wouldn't we do that?
Yeah, creating jobs and storage for these things all over the country. It's frustrating because it is the obvious. I understand why that teacher would want to study the book now. And another philosophy, and I think the backbone of a lot of, you know, the stuff that you teach and educate and talk about, you also have your five goods. Mm-hmm. Let's break down each good and how they work alone and together to be an integral, you know, part of how you think and how you design.
Well, the five goods are based on cradle to cradle, and they are, first, do safe, healthy materials for humans and ecosystems. So we get the chemistries, we get the physics, we get the various things going. So we understand this is ecological and human health. Good. So make goods, not bads.
Check.
Number one,
right.
Good materials. Number two, good economy. A good economy would be circular. Let's do it again.
Yes.
So we get stuff back, do it again. They would be sharing. So when you look at things like Uber, Airbnb, we're sharing space and it's being more efficient with things we have already. And we're able to share them more gracefully and generally. But also a shared economy. The one that we have now, we worry that like a lot of wealth is concentrated in a few people and the wealth is not necessarily shared across the population. So that's important that we do it that way. So it needs to be good practical work that everybody can benefit from. Third is good energy. Well, good energy is clean energy, period. So we're looking for 100% renewably powered or clean energy systems. That's it. So the products that we support in our certification programs and the work, all those companies are going toward 100% renewably powered. And they track their progress, and that's how this works. It's exciting. And when companies like Walmart go for 100% renewable power, that's serious business.
And they're doing that?
And they're doing that. So,
can I stop you right there? Isn't that a story that needs to be told?
Sure.
And is Walmart telling that story, or are you guys telling that story?
That's Walmart's story, and it's for their operations. And they are committed to being 100% renewably powered. And every time they see an opportunity to put in renewable power in a cost-effective way for their shareholders, they take it. So, because renewable power is now cost-effective in so many places, they've not only been leading, but now they can really manifest it at scale all over the place. It's great. But because their goal is not just to save a little energy or do this or that, it's to be 100% renewably powered.
So it's
very focused.
Deal. Yeah, it's a really, really big deal.
It's a positive goal.
Yeah. I keep cutting you off, but there's just a lot to talk about.
Fourth is clean water. So we've designed textiles with the companies where the chemistries are so clean and perfect that the water coming out of the process, instead of being toxic, you know, textile plant, black rivers running out of it.
Right.
Their water is drinking water, clean enough to drink. In the case of a project in Switzerland, the water was even purified in the factory from Swiss drinking water, which is pretty exciting.
That's really cool.
And in India, we have a factory where the only water leaving the factory is by evaporation. So that's distilled water leaving a factory. How exciting.
Very.
And then last is good lives. So for us, good lives are creative. They're safe. It's really life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And all of those in order to make, you know, not necessarily make a product certifiable, but to kind of check all your boxes, they have to all work in tandem, right? They have to all work together.
You're improving all of them all the time.
I think all of those also kind of lead me into the next portion, which is the upcycling portion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I work in the industry and I think upcycling is a cute name for a very important process. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's an important concept in the circular economy and it's how we should and could and hopefully will be doing things. Again, for people that may not know, you know, define upcycling and what are some unique examples of upcycling as well?
Well, first I'd have to say, you know, we wrote the second book is The Upcycle. There are different ways to see upcycling. For some people, they see upcycling as something goes to a higher use. So if a soda bottle became a fleece, they might say that's upcycling because it used to be a lowly water bottle and now it's an exalted fleece jacket. For us, it's a little different. We're looking at qualification, not just quantification. So we're looking at upcycling as things get better. So if you took a plastic bottle that had catalytic residues or something in it, like antimony, and you actually took those out as you reprocessed the polyester, terephthalate in that case, then you could convert it into clean PET. And that's upcycling. It got better because you recycled it.
So it's not that the end product got better. It's that the actual raw material.
The end product is whatever it is.
Right.
But it would be great if it was a good instead of a recycled bad in a new form.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's those two things. You can change the purpose and you can also change the qualification. It's exciting. So we can take plastics back and purify them. I think with the amount of plastic waste coming in, it's so huge. Immense. I mean, see what's going on in the oceans. That's the beginning.
So that's what I want to talk about also. Yeah. So tell me about some of the work that you guys are doing for the plastics pollution and ocean cleanup. It's a big topic that we've discussed a lot on the podcast with a lot of different influencers this year. Mm. I mean, it's as scary and as bad as we think out there, right?
It's pretty bad. Yeah, it's bad.
It's not a good, it's a bad.
It's about to get worse. We're going to see it increase by orders of magnitude.
Wow.
In the very near future. So essentially, what's happened is the throwaway, single-use culture, especially in Southeast Asia, where the bulk of it's coming from, China, Indonesia, and the Pacific Rim, that the polymers get in the rivers, and then they have big event storms, typhoons, and cyclones, and so on, and then it just comes flying into the oceans. So what we're looking at is, how can we clean that up? And so we're developing systems, we're designing nets, we're designing ship systems that can integrate with us. We can do all kinds of things that we need to do. We're concerned because we see a few things that are interesting, but they're not necessarily going to do cost-effective work in the short term. So we're trying to think of how to really deploy at a very large scale. But I think part of that is what we call chemical recycling, that it's such a mixed bag that you get. Mm-hmm. Some of it will have barnacles on it. Some of it will be this plastic, that plastic. That we're looking at systems like chemical recycling, which is essentially taking this stuff and actually heating it up without oxygen and turning it back to monomers for polymers or to oil, basically, and then start over. So, and then we can take out the sludges that are toxic from all the strange inks and things we put in these things and purify it, upcycle it.
So that's the upcycling.
That's the upcycle at a global scale.
Right.
That's something I'm very focused on. The other stuff we're doing is redesigning the plastics themselves and the packaging systems upstream, because we're going to start with the oceans because it's so emblematic. But we're going to use things that clean up the land, too, at the same time, and then work our way up to the design. So all the design of these things are designed for next use.
Yeah. My last question, and then we're going to get into play a really fun game.
Okay.
It's still just more about upcycling. How can someone, you know, we're talking about upcycling on a global scale. You know, we're talking about literally redesigning, like, ships for collection for chemical recycling. But how can somebody upcycle things in their own home? What are a couple little small things that people can do on a more local scale to help move that circular economy?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly recycling in any way is appropriate as the best you can given the municipal circumstances.
Right.
But also I think certainly composting is something I love to do. And if you're in that situation where you can't do that.
You compost at home?
I do. But I think those kinds of things are great and they're great for the kids, you know. And so that's really recycling of organic material mm-hmm. back to something that might have a higher purpose, which is, you know, your spinach.
Yeah.
You know, high nutrition and home and good exercise, good connection to soil, that kind of thing. I think you can other repurpose things. I have a hierarchy of use in plastic design. The first I call refuse. So instead of just reduce, reuse, recycle, The first is refuse, which is funny because in the garbage business, we have refuse and they're spelled the same. So refuse. You just put the same word twice. Yeah. So if you refuse, you stop and say, I don't want single-use packaging. So I refuse the water bottle. Thank you. I'll use a glass of water. So
right.
I refuse. Then there's reuse. So now I'm going to take a water bottle and use it over and over again as my water bottle. Fine. Mm-hmm. That's reuse. Those kinds of things. Then we have recyclable. But if it's not recycled, then that was a nice idea, but we're not there yet. So, and then we have compostable, which means all the way to hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Not tiny bits of plastic, not just biodegradable into little bits of plastic. It's compostable.
Which I do think is an important distinction.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people mix up compostable and biodegradable,
right,
and thinking that they're one and the same.
Right. We like it to go all the way to carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. And right. Then nature can absorb it again. So it's not tiny bits of plastic. And then this recoverable, it's critical. So we have systems to recover it, which is why I'm excited about companies like Rubicon. And then there's refuse at the end, which is the stuff we don't know what to do with. And so we'll probably end up burning it for waste, or we'll end up putting it in a landfill because we don't know what to do with it. But let's keep that to the minimum and try and eliminate it altogether.
And if you do steps, you know, 1 through 4, you'll have less refuse.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, Bill, we're going to play rapid fire.
Okay.
These are 10 questions that are just going to kind of help the audience and myself get to know you better. You know, they have very little to do with everything that we've talked about today. And you ready? Just say
yes.
The first thing that comes to your head.
Okay.
What does your morning routine look like?
Get up early.
What's early for you?
4:35 o'clock.
Yeah, that's early.
workout, 6:30. Breakfast, very light, mostly vegetables. And then begin the day of work.
And who's the last person that you texted?
My wife.
Can I just say, every husband that I've ever interviewed on this show and asked him that question, that's always the answer.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing about it.
Texting. Where's your dream vacation destination?
Home.
Where do you see the future of, you know, cradle to cradle headed?
I see it headed into the joy of coming generations, seeing the world get better every day instead of worse.
What is your favorite restaurant in Charlottesville?
10 Japanese restaurant.
What are you reading right now?
I'm reading Ray Dalio's book called Principles.
What was the first concert you ever saw?
Van Morrison.
That's a good one. When you were a kid, what did you want it to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be someone who could travel around the world and see things and collect things and then share them with other people. And that's what I do.
Yeah, what's one piece of advice that you'd give to a millennial that's trying to do their part sustainably? You know, we've talked about the recycling, but from an educational perspective, how can people educate themselves further on what's going on in the sustainability space?
I think following your bliss, as Joseph Campbell said, in whatever area you're interested in. So if you're interested in architecture, do that. If you're interested in engineering, do that. If you're interested in finance, do that. But bring this to it. So I think doing the thing that you love to do, whatever that is, and then do it this way. That's powerful.
I love that. And lastly, what does success mean to you?
Happy children.
Bill, thank you so much for coming on today, coming all the way down to Atlanta. It was so much fun to learn and grow and learn a lot about what you're doing. Where can people find the book? Where can people learn more about all the awesome stuff that you guys are doing?
Well, Cradle to Cradle is a seminal book. And it's available anywhere.
And
you can read in the bathtub. And then also you can just explore my curiosities with me at mcdonough.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.